Blog Talk Radio.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's on 31 and he's only 17. A soldier for a thousand years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting in Canada, he's fighting in France, he's fighting in the USA, and he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way, and he's fighting for democracy, or fighting for the red, he says it for the peace of all. To die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon in a war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. This is not the way we put an end to war.
Woohoo! It's finally over. The latest so-called contest between so-called candidates in this so-called democratic country of ours is over. I couldn't be happier to see it go. Aside from the supposed main event, in which the reigning war criminal beat up the guy who said he was soft on foreign policy, there were actually some surprisingly positive results. Three states approved equal marriage rights for those of the same gender. Two states approved the use of marijuana without a prescription. In my state of Florida, shot down 8 of 11 amendments to the state constitution. I actually voted for one of the ones that passed. And, well, I voted against all the others. But I thought an extra homestead exemption tax for the elderly sounded like a decent idea. The other two that passed had to do with some kind of help for veterans, another homestead thing, I think. They certainly weren't the worst ones on the ballot. The ones that got shot down, well, one of them would have basically overturned Obamacare for Florida. Another would have provided for state funding for churches. And another one would have restricted abortion. And they were all turned down pretty handily. Who knew that Floridians had that much sense? You know, Obama is likely to feel that he got a mandate to continue what he's doing. After all, he exceeded the margin of victory not only for G.W. Bush. Well, actually, old Shrub didn't even win the popular vote. But Obama also bested Carter, Nixon, and Kennedy in terms of popular vote margin. We're not as divided as we thought, he says. So I guess we have to brace ourselves. But perhaps we can hope. Perhaps with this problem of getting reelected and being put to rest, the guy can start doing what we expected when we voted him in back in 2008. You know, this is it. This is the second term. He can let it all hang out. Nothing can complete him from, nothing can keep him from completing his mission now. Of course, that's assuming he doesn't get himself impeached or assassinated, because, you know, bad things seem to happen to Democrats in their second term. You never know. Of course, even Republicans have problems sometimes. Maybe it's because the that election stuff out of the way, the purse strings and puppet strings might not be so firmly attached. Anyway, we can hope for some real change this time. I'm not going to hold my breath any more than I'll hold back my voice. Because if anything, I think it's time to raise our voices more than ever. Let them know what we want. Let's make sure we ask for those right things, too. Remember that old saying about being careful what you ask for. I'd like to play a little clip from Bill Hicks to get us into the right frame of mind for the rest of the show.
It's just a ride, and we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream radio show, where we try to do our bit to create a better America and a better world.
We welcome special guest Susan Clark in Vermont, and Sam Smith in Maine. And so tonight we're gathering together for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Vermont, Maine, and wherever you are. I would say this is America, right? This right here, right now, this radio show. Something small, going forth, doing the right thing, just pushing forward. This radio project, I think that's America, and that's what I think. The Minnesota Wolf Hunt began November 3rd, 50 wolves were killed that first weekend, and the hunt continues. The good news is that the Chippewa Ojibwe tribe of Minnesota has banned wolf hunting on their lands. For them, killing the animals is unthinkable. To guard against it, all 7 of Minnesota's Ojibwe bands forbid wolf hunting on their lands. They've also issued strongly worded proclamations declaring wolf sanctuaries, banning wolf hunting by anyone, Indian or non-Indian, within their boundaries. And Ruth and I have symbolically joined them by banning wolf hunting on our 5 acres. I sent a letter to the editor of the area papers on Tuesday morning. The letter went like this. We join with the protesters of the wolf hunt and with the Ojibwe tribes of Minnesota who have banned wolf hunting within their borders. There is no reason for this wolf hunt. We declare that wolf hunting is also banned on our property. Mike and Ruth Polichek, Saginaw, Minnesota. Okay, the election. We have again elected Barack SpongeBob Buried at Sea Obama, the liar, the CIA agent, the murderer, as our savior against the crazy guy, just as it was planned to look like a real election. This is Kevin Barrett over in Wisconsin on election Tuesday. I think he said it best. Wear black to mourn the death of real choice in America elections on Tuesday. Wear black to remind everyone that black box voting machines do not count votes. They fabricate election outcomes. Wear black in solidarity with black Americans whose votes have been repeatedly stolen since the 15th Amendment supposedly enfranchised them. Wear black to mourn the murders of JFK, RFK, MLK, Paul Wellstone, and Karl Rove's top 2004 computer geek vote thief, Mike Connell, who was killed shortly before he was scheduled to testify in court against Rule for stealing the 2004 presidential election. Wear black to mourn the murders you are paying for, the murders of millions of innocent people in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Palestine, Iran, and elsewhere. Murders that will continue, paid for by your tax dollars, no matter who wins the election. Wear black to mourn the fact that you have been made a murderer by your so-called government. Wear black to mourn the fact that your Constitution is a dead letter. Wear black to mourn the fact that you and your compatriots are too cowardly to do anything about it. Whoever you vote for, whether or not you even bother to vote, by dressing in black for Black Tuesday, you'll be sending a message. We know that the American people do not have a real choice in this election. We know that our democracy is dead. We know that our press is completely controlled and that the news is Orwellian propaganda. We know that our government has murdered the truth. We mourn the passing of this once decent country. We mourn the countless victims of this evil regime. When the truth is dead, when goodness is dead, when evil reigns supreme and unopposed, at the least that good people can do is mourn. If we do not protest, if only by wearing black on Black Tuesday, it means that our own minds, hearts, and souls are as dead as our defunct democracy. That's Kevin Barrett. Well, we protest. We protest here by speaking, and we have that freedom not because of the killing of soldiers, but by the courage of protesters throughout our history. We hope that we walk in their footsteps, and we surely seek to do so here on the New American Dream Radio Show. Okay, back to you, Chuck.
Now, we ask that you sit back, relax, maybe enjoy some popcorn and a beverage. Listen to another episode of We Were Weathermen. We Were Weathermen is sponsored by Jiffy Pop, Jiffy Plop, big old popcorn, all you can ask for from a little old seed. Get a buttload of Jiffy Plop today.
Now we pop in again to visit the ongoing world of We Were Weathermen. Steve and Sally Storm sat silently surveying seashells on the seashore, sailing ships. The ships were sewn cigarette packs and swizzle sticks. But there were no ships, no shells, no seashore. Only the silence was sentient, alive, breathing, real. "So, Steve," said Sally softly, yet sort of seriously. "Yeah, what?" he said. And that was how the morning went, as it often did, the two married weather persons in their cubicle at the station, dreaming their tropical dreams, each just knowing what the other was dreaming. Two storms did the weather for station WMOKX in St. Joe. Being weather persons was not their first career choice, not what Sid Abramowitz and Alicia McCarthy had dreamed of back in their days at Columbia University, sitting in the primary colored chairs in the outer office of the newly founded Tourism Management Department. How did they know it was only a front for the CIA and there would be no internship with Hilton of Honolulu or Russian Ballet Tour Group to Tashkent, as the many-colored department brochure had proclaimed? They had been told by Mr. Phelps, their faculty advisor — they were already a team, a couple famous on the South Lawn with their long strides, their long yellow hair, strolling hand in hand — that as part of the requirements of the tourism management major, they would need to become part of one of the local student groups to seek out the individuals in those groups and find out what their likes and interests were in order to more efficiently serve their travel and tourism needs. Mr. Phelps suggested the weathermen. So Sid and Alicia made bombs in their dorm rooms and the off-campus apartments of the other students in the group after the bars and library closed. And after they completed their papers and turned them in, they were told they needed to go on to the internship portion of tourism management, which was a weatherman relocation program, as it were. They would become actual weather persons as part of their graduation requirements, which Alicia Sally was starting to wonder about. Mr. Phelps was so often just such a kidder. But even so, they had taken to the job, learned all about fronts and arrows on maps and big dipping lines and alto cumulus clouds and shit. Their shared cubicle was stacked and packed with various weather props, part of the show, their shtick, their routine. The little doodads helped a lot when they went on to the different schools to do talks about the weather. The giant Scruffy the lost tornado dog, Jimmy the drowned duck, all that fun stuff. And they had to come to it. They had come to love the weather, and they wanted to call a spade a spade. That is so racist, is what Alicia Sally had said. Okay, a shovel, agreed, said Steve. No weatherman had actually yet said the words global warming on camera. But the word unseasonably was becoming a real problem from overuse, cliche. The weather is nothing if not current, new, hip, the latest. They heard rumblings in the restrooms at the various Amarillo weather conferences, and after the first usage of global warming, it would be all over. Then eventually even the Today Show weathermen would be forced to follow suit, and there would be no more weather. Oh, for a while there would be lots of weather, lots of work, probably even a few new meteorology schools constructed to handle the load. But after the tornadoes and floods and hurricanes and all the rest, all that through by that first utterance of the term, things would settle like flat water on a lake, and that would be that. All there would be left for the weather persons to do would be to make a brief appearance on camera, make a joke with the hosts at the news desk and the sports guy over there, smile and throw up the hands and say, well, folks, it's hot, and then go home. Pretty soon there would be automated graphics packages to do even that tiny bit, and there would be no more need for the jolly, quirky weather guy or weather girl with the giant boobs, and it would be all gone, all gone. And it would be the fault of Sid and Alicia, a.k.a. Steve and Sally Storm, who had blown the whistle just as they had ended the revolution. And then where would they go? Where would Mr. Phelps send them now? What requirements were they still lacking for their degrees? Maybe they would be sent to drive the ice cream truck and ring the bell up and down the dirt streets in Valentine, Nebraska, or be grizzly bear hunting guides in Southwest Jersey. They wanted to have a family settled down, but they needed their degrees first. That's the first thing an employer is going to ask. They needed a base, a foundation, some place to start. Sid Steve looked online to try to get information from the Columbia Registrar, but found out he did not exist, had never attended Columbia, had no college credit after how many years? Well, anyway, the show must go on.
At 5 p.m., just like the sun coming up every morning, Steve and Sally Storm put on their game faces, got ready, and sprang into action. Steve and Sally Storm in their salty, secure, somnolent circle cubicle at the carefully choreographed queue, like synchronized swimmers, pushed back their chairs from their computers, bumping their backs, swiveling around. They stood in high five and trot out to the set. "It's happening, St. Joe," they both screamed. They squatted and fired pistol shots with pointed index fingers at the camera. "Hey, hot out there today, huh?" smiled Steve. "Looks like we're in for some weather," Sally smooshed up her face close to the camera. "Unseasonably warm, looks like," said Steve as he moved to the side, pointed at his map with a big blow-up red and yellow pencil he cuddled in both arms. Sally handed out red, yellow, and green suckers to the cameraman and the news team. And Steve and Sally Storm wanted to talk about Hurricane Sandy and how it was just another manifestation of global warming, or might be a government HAARP thing, where the government, by that HAARP thing in Alaska, can manufacture weather events for whatever purpose, who knows. Maybe that's how they did the Fukushima thing, but nobody but Jesse Ventura ever mentions that. Yep, they talked about that at home in front of the fire, eating popcorn, drinking wine, about how they do it. Finally do it. Say global warming on the air, live at 5, to the people in the studio right there, right out front. When they got out there, you know, Sally's sanding out the suckers, everyone's smiling and laughing, and it was all good. We're all on the same page. It just didn't seem like the right time. You know, you understand? Good. So good that you understand. Important that you understand. Steve and Sally only want to be liked and loved and stay on the same page with every one of you. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode of We Were Weathermen. We'll find out what Steve and Sally Storm do when they're scheduled to appear at Carl Rove Elementary School and the TV station SUV they're driving is thrown into a ravine by a sudden storm. One of them falls into a well, and one of them can't find the cell phone or the weather map pointer thing. Oh, buy some Jiffy Flop right now.
Our first guest is Susan Clark. Susan Clark is the author of a new book called Slow Democracy. She is an award-winning radio commentator and former talk show co-host. Her democratic activism has earned her broad recognition, including the 2010 Vermont Secretary of State's Enduring Democracy Award. Susan Clark is the co-author of All Those in Favor, Rediscovering the Secrets of Town Meeting and Community. Her work strengthening communities has included directing a community activist network and facilitating town visioning forums. She served as communication and education director of the Vermont Natural Resources Council and coordinator of the University of Vermont's Environmental Program and Communities Project. Susan Clark lives in Middlesex, Vermont, where she chairs a committee that encourages citizen involvement and serves as town meeting moderator. Susan, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Hello, this is Mike. How are you doing tonight?
Good.
Good. Susan, could you tell us a little bit about the book Slow Democracy? When did it come out, just now, or is it available?
It just came out in October, and it's available now.
Can you tell us a little bit about the book, please?
Sure. Yeah. You know, we named it Slow Democracy, and a lot of people think, oh, great, you know, is this a critique because democracy is too slow, you know, because we know, of course, of the gridlock at the national level. Or other people think, wait, are you saying it's not slow enough? But, you know, what we've done here, slow is kind of a tongue-in-cheek term. We're taking inspiration from the slow food movement. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners know slow food, you know, argues that, you know, fast food just symbolizes so much of what's wrong with the world today in the name of, you know, efficiency. We've kind of centralized and overprocessed the meaning out of our lives. And, you know, it really argues that we should know where our food comes from and, you know, recognize our connection to agriculture and to the natural system. Well, you know, that's what we're arguing with Slow Democracy, is that we should reconnect with our decision-making, reconnect to our home places and to our local democracy. And that way we can make better informed, more sustainable decisions using local knowledge.
And what I take it as being, I think you just said that, to be the hard work, the day-to-day, go-to-the-meeting work. That's, I used to work for a couple weekly newspapers, you know, going to meetings can take a long time, and maybe you don't get the big happening, the big thing that you would hope to happen, but it just takes a long time. Is that kind of what you mean, just doing the hard work?
Absolutely, doing the hard work, but also when you think about slow food, at least I think of, you know, slow-cooked, delicious meals, like really tasty, local, well-made, fresh meals. And I don't think of slow food as just meaning that I like to wait around for my food. And it's the same thing with slow democracy. We are defining slow democracy with a really rigorous standards. We don't want just plain old hard, long meetings. You know, we're looking at some really new, innovative techniques for involving people and really making sure that they're in on the ground level of important decision-making. So we're defining slow democracy with three elements. It's local decision-making with three elements. We want to make sure it's inclusive, meaning not just that, you know, everybody gets a representative, but that everybody really gets to be involved if they want to be. Then we want to make sure it's deliberative, which means that you don't just show up and cast a ballot, but you really get to have a conversation right from the beginning in framing the issues so that you're not just, you know, deciding between A and B, but really getting a chance to kind of co-create C, you know, the different option. So it's a very collaborative process. And then the third one is that it's empowered. We don't want to just have conversations and then, you know, go home and hope that somebody was listening. In a slow democracy process, you know that what you say is going to be taken into consideration and that real change is going to happen.
I haven't seen the book, but are there examples in the book of how this might work or how it has worked?
Absolutely, yeah. That was one of the funnest parts for us of writing the book. Was really fun to go and look at all the exciting changes that are happening at the local level. I think that the time is really right, and there are communities all across the United States that are using some of these new techniques. A good example would be Portsmouth, New Hampshire. It's an old port city town, has about 20,000 people, and it's right on the border of New Hampshire and Maine. And that's a city, I'll just tell you a little story. It's a city that used to have an Air Force base in it, but it shut down. And when it did, they lost about 4,000 military personnel and another 2,400 related jobs. And it really skewed the attendance at the elementary schools. Their city had three schools. And two of them got very, very under-enrolled. They were empty classrooms. And one of them was bursting at the seams. People, you know, kids being caught, you know, in the hallways. But it was very hard politically to, you know, shift any kids. You know, anybody who's dealt with local school issues knows that redistricting is very, very tricky. So Portsmouth struggled for a decade trying to figure out a solution, didn't get anywhere, complete gridlock for 10 years. And finally, they got desperate, and they used a process called study circles. And study circles, it's organized by a group called Everyday Democracy, if people want to Google that. It's a great process that uses all the elements of slow democracy. It's very inclusive. It's quite deliberative, and there's a good link to power. So in Portsmouth, that really just meant that they broke up into small groups. They got lots and lots of people involved, first of all, using community organizing. And then they broke up into small groups and really were able to build trust in those small groups. And so it wasn't a combative process. It was very much of a dialogue. They got to visit the three schools, talk with the principals, got some really good sound information. And over the course of several weeks, came up with really being able to identify the underlying values that they all shared in terms of what they wanted for the school decision coming up. They were able to share that with the school board, and the school board, of course, was dying for that information. They implemented it in a proposal that was very well-informed because, of course, there had been, you know, over 100 citizens who had been trooped into the schools and informing that decision. And in the end, they had a $2 million facility improvement that you know, received broad support and was approved. And it was so well-informed that only 65 students had to switch schools. So you can see that it will only take a few months. And so it's kind of funny to call it slow democracy because compared to 10 years of gridlock, it was really quite fast.
Some people might say that America is broken, that this democracy is broken, it doesn't work anymore, that there's too much money, and that it's that what we really need is a revolution. Can you give me an argument for slow democracy over revolution?
You know, in many ways, slow democracy is a revolution. It's revolutionary in many ways, and the most important one to me is power. It is saying, we know at the local level how these changes need to be made, and it's not going to be that top-down, hierarchical, efficiency-first model that drove the Industrial Revolution. It is going to be a third wave of bottom-up decision-making, and we're going to take back our communities. And what we see is that when communities together come up with good solutions, our local governments are quite responsive to those good ideas, especially in this economy. We're looking for great solutions. And what we can do is take back our local and then state and federal governments from within using the democratic tools that, to a degree, are still ours and certainly at the local level are still ours. And that will allow us to make that revolutionary change you're talking about.
Well, I've got one last question. I assume that book, this model, does liberal or conservative. I would imagine that you're hoping for that, and I imagine you're hoping that you can expand beyond Vermont, and maybe it already has. But could you say how you might do that? If it would work with both liberal or conservative groups or communities, how you might expand it beyond the Northeast?
Oh, yes. Well, absolutely. We have examples from all over the country, and it is already happening. It's happening in California. It's happening in Chicago. It's happening in Oregon. So it is absolutely a national movement. And, you know, really, the Tea Party hates big government. The Occupy movement hates big corporations. What we're saying is big is just probably not a good idea in general. There are certain cases where we need to make decisions, you know, at the national level in cases of things like civil rights, perhaps. But, you know, we argue that centralization and privatization are both enemies of democracy, and we're seeing a great response from both right and left. Bill McKibben, you know, endorsed the book and said, this is a truly important book. It will lead you, liberal or conservative, down the logical path toward a working society.
Okay. Now, this is really my last question. You talk about we. Could you mention who your co-author is and also tell us again the name of the book and where people can go to get more information about you and the book or where to buy the book?
Sure, absolutely. So my name is Susan Clark, and my co-author's name is Woden Teachout. And Woden is a historian and a professor, actually, of history. And she and I co-authored the book, and people can find it at slowdemocracy.org.
And I imagine bookstores everywhere, or you tried to sell it yourself, or?
No. It's published through Chelsea Green, which is nationally distributed. So you can find it on Amazon, but you can also find it at bookstores everywhere, and in particular, of course, independent bookstores all over the country.
Okay. Well, and do you have any upcoming events or speak engagements you want to plug or anything?
Let's see. Boy, I've been really, really busy the last few weeks, but I'm not sure I have anything nationally relevant coming up now. But people can check slowdemocracy.org, and we're also on Facebook at Slow Democracy.
I saw on your website that you had a number of recent radio interviews, and I appreciate you appreciate your taking the time to visit with us tonight, and thank you for your work, and have a good night, Susan.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
You bet.
Bye.
See ya.
Hello. Hoping you're all well. Hello, and a pleasant morning or evening to you all. Hello. I'm Mitch McGillicuddy Schwarzenhager. Hello. Now it's time for Interview with a Terrorist, your Sunday morning talk show live from Washington, D.C. The Patriot Act, TSC, Homeland Security, the FBI, the CIA, lots of other stuff. How many millions of dollars go towards all that? Paid for by moms working 9 jobs every day, getting up to take their kids to daycare at 4:30 every morning. Today, we'll visit with a few of the folks who've made all this possible. The gradual, then lightning-quick transition from America to Freedom Fries City. Tonight, or this morning, depending on the time zone, curvature of the earth, daylight savings time, an interview with a terrorist. We're joined in our studio by some people shrouded in mystery, rarely seen. Our guests are seated across from me at this moment in the shadows. The curtains are closed, so I can't see their faces. I know they're there because I can see the rest of their bodies. Our guests, well, we'll simply call them Mr. Terrorist for the purposes of our conversation this evening. They've agreed to the interview just as long as we disguise their voices. Before we begin, let me tell you, you'll be able to hear the voices of our Mr. Terrorists just fine, as if they're seated in your living room, even though the thought of that might send shivers down your spine. Well, in fact, our garbling machine's broken, or we can't find it. Actually, we doubt such a thing exists, maybe a Harry Potter alternative universe, you know, but we've asked our terrorists to garble their words as they speak. And then, thanks to the 7-second delay, which does exist, our technicians will be able to run those words through the washer, and you'll hear the real voice of our in-studio terrorists. All very, very complicated, but beyond your imagination. Just trust us. We'll not be able to know who they all are and all that, so let's proceed, shall we? Call it a willing suspension of disbelief. That might help. Good evening, honored terrorists. This morning's guests, Barack Obama, George Bush, Bill Clinton, Janet Reno, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, and Colin Powell. What we'd like to know is who you really are, how you got to this position, who tells you what to do, why you do it. Why have you not either killed yourself by now or at least confessed, told the rest of us what's really happening behind the curtains of our world? Who wants to go first? Barack Obama, George Bush, Bill Clinton, Janet Reno, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell? Uh-oh. Fun fact, FYI, to our audience, Condoleezza Rice has slipped into the shadows into a chair next to another of our special terrorists. Come on, we know none of you are shy. Criminally insane, well, maybe, but, you know, not shy. Come on. Black Mamba! You bury your courage at sea again? Tricky Dick, is that your shotgun, or are you just glad to be here? Hey, doing a great job there, Bushy. How's your golf game? You travel much? Heard there's a warrant out in about 12 countries if you ever fly the friendly skies, my friend. How about you? You in the I Spoke at the UN t-shirt. Janet, you lifting weights again? Look marvelous. Hey, Condoleezza, you must be on break from that sweet teaching gig at Stanford. You must let anyone in there, right? Of course I'm kidding, huh? Not. Bill Clinton, there you are. Such a tan, even in the dark. Flying too close to the sun again, Icarus? Those long reptile fingers, you know, you look just like E.T. You glow and radiate in the dark, Bill. Do you know that? Come on, guys. 9/11, Oklahoma City, Waco, burying Osama bin Laden at sea, weapons of mass destruction, you know the drill. Come on, guys. This is not Nuremberg, the Hague. Not yet. This little old national televised Sunday morning TV political talk show. How about it just between you and me? Let's pretend we're sitting alone at your kitchen table drinking some good old American-made coffee. How about El Salvador, Chile, Allende, Libya? Libya, anyone? Guatemala. Well, folks, this is Mitch McGillicuddy Schwarzenegger. You've been watching Interview with a Terrorist, sponsored by Marlboro. Good day, good night, good morning, and goodbye.
And now we bring you the New American Dream Big Commercial, sponsored by Budweiser, Gillette, Chevrolet, Ford, the NBA, the U.S. Army, Google, Nike, CNN, and lots of other people who bring you this real person who really can say these things on regular American TV and radio and in the newspaper to millions of people. And nobody gets fired or killed. Jim Fetzer. Jim Fetzer says the evidence that none of the official plane crashes actually took place is simply overwhelming, even if there are 9/11 truth groups that want to avoid it. Not only did Flight 77 not hit the Pentagon, but Flight 93 did not crash in Shanksville. And even though we have all seen videos purporting to show Flight 11 hit the North Tower and Flight 175 hit the South, we know that those videos are faked or fabricated one way or another. As Pilots for 9/11 Truth has shown, Flight 93 was in the air on 9/11, but was over Champaign-Urbana after it had purportedly crashed in Shanksville, and Flight 175 was also in the air, but it was over Harrisburg in Pittsburgh, long after it purportedly effortlessly entered the South Tower. Indeed, FAA registration records show that the plane corresponding to those flights were not deregistered or firmly taken out of service until September 28, 2005, which means that none of the official plane crashes actually took place. Jim Fetzer, it has been astonishing to me to discover that the atrocities of 9/11 were not simply allowed to happen, but come closer to having been produced as a Hollywood-style spectacle with phantom flights, faked phone calls, and fabricated crash sites. Anyone who wants to continue in a state of naive belief in their government as a nurturing institution that is dedicated to the best interests of the American people and to promoting their welfare should read no further, because 9/11 appears to have been a national security event that was approved at the highest levels of the Bush-Cheney administration, including the CIA, the Pentagon, the NSA, and the White House itself. When consideration is given to the totality of the evidence, no alternative explanation is reasonable. This has been the New American Dream Big Commercial, sponsored by Budweiser, Gillette, Chevrolet, Ford, the NBA, Google, Nike, CNN, the National Football League, and lots of other people who bring you this real person who really can say these things on regular American TV and radio and in the newspapers to millions of people, and nobody gets fired or killed.
Our second guest tonight is Sam Smith, the publisher of the Progressive Review, longtime journalist. He's done some radio stuff, and he's been a guest on our show several times. The last time we talked to him, we were talking about what might happen after the election, and so we thought this would be a great time to bring him back to see what he has to say. Sam, welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
Well, you heard what I want to talk about. What do you got to say?
What do I have to say? Well, I looked at this election as sort of a one-night stand, that I was going to support Obama because I thought that what was going on in the Republican Party was the most retroactive, reactionary, and dangerous thing that we've seen in this country politically since the Civil War. I mean, essentially, the Republican policy is essentially to reverse 80 years of progress. And, you know, conservatives usually used to just want to stand still, but this was really an extraordinary situation. But once having gotten the guy elected, now we've got to move on to other things, which are his problems, and we've got plenty of them. And so I think that's a good place to start. And a good place to start, I think, would be if liberals would recognize the fact that our last two Democratic presidents have been the most conservative Democratic presidents we've had since Woodrow Wilson. And they get treated as though they were liberals, but they're not. You know, when you consider Bill Clinton signed off on doing away with the Glass-Steagall Act. He basically took apart public welfare, and then all the things that Obama has done. They're basically very, very conservative people.
Well, that's certainly true. What do you propose that we do about it?
Well, I think there are a number of things that would be helpful. Strangely enough, one thing that people can learn is from the Obama campaign, which part of its strength was in its ground organization. And I think that activist groups, very much like political groups, have over the past couple of decades gotten very technological. And so they've gone into things like robocalls and clicktivism on the internet, and we forget that the way to change people's minds is to have actual contact with them. So I would put that very high up on the list of things to do, is to change the way that activist groups deal with actual human beings. So you don't do it all through the mail or over the internet.
So should people go door to door or have rallies?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think you have to do it. It may seem a little bit old-fashioned, but it actually works. Because, give you an example, there was a study done of the effectiveness of various forms of campaigning. And as I recall, if you go door to door, you stand one chance in 14 of convincing somebody to come out and vote your way. If you do a robocall, it's one, you have to do 200 calls to make a difference.
I got 200.
Yeah, in a way, we've sort of gotten a little bit lazy. You know, I think that's part of the problem. And I think that I've seen some signs of this changing. The best sign I heard of, I was talking to a cousin of mine, and her 3-year-old son was doing calls. And I said, my God, what was he saying? He said he'd say, "Hi, Barack Obama, bye."
Well, that probably was at least as intelligent as some of the other calls.
Right. But I think that's something. Then the other thing is that I think that there has been a tendency for activist organizations to it's sort of become too isolated from other groups. And so there hasn't been a movement in this country, a real movement that is broad since the 60s. And I think that one of the reasons for this is that activist groups have, for some very practical reasons, like how do you raise money and how do you get people to pay attention to you. And in the course of worrying about all those things, they've become a little bit isolated from other groups, even though they have so much in common. So I think we have to figure out how to create alliances again.
Well, would you agree that Occupy seems to be an attempt to unify some of those protests into one?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's true. I think that the one problem with Occupy is that what you need when you have that sort of thing going is then you have to have sort of a milder activism around it, because not everybody's going to want to be an occupier. And so it's not a matter of either or. It's a matter of you want both. You want something for the lazy people. You want some for the people who can be active on weekend, and then you want some for the fully committed.
Looking at the recent election results and the big event, as it were, Jill Stein of the Green Party ended up coming in fourth with Gary Johnson actually getting almost 1% of the vote. Do you have any feelings about what any of that means, if anything?
Well, I do. I was one of the people who helped get the National Green Party going, but I've been a little bit out of sync with a lot of Greens, because I really don't think that spending time on presidential campaigns is a good way to organize. If you look at the history of third parties, they've had very, very few chances of making an impact at the presidential level. Where they've been effective is at grassroots organizing. The populists, the progressives, the socialists. You know, at one point we had something like 50 elected socialist mayors and other officials in this country. We forget that. I mean, as recently when I married my wife, who was from Wisconsin, from Milwaukee, they had a socialist mayor in Milwaukee. And then you had parties like the Liberal Party in New York, which was very strong. The thing that they had going for them was that New York law allowed what you call fusion politics. In other words, you could appear on the Democratic ticket and the Liberal ticket, or the Republican ticket and the Liberal ticket. So they became very powerful. One of the interesting things about that was that fusion politics was so successful that in the late 19th century, early 20th century, lots and lots of states banned it because it worked. And so I think if you're looking for something to bring back, that would be one. Now, the other third party that I was involved with was the D.C. Statehood Party in Washington, D.C. And when we started that back in 1970, there wasn't a lot to go on, you know, in figuring out how you get a third party going. But for 25 years, we had a member in either the city council and or the school board. And I just saw some stats the other day, is that in yesterday's election, the Statehood Party got something like 83,000 votes. That's now called the Statehood Green Party. And it's the number one party in the city. I mean, they got more votes than the Republicans did. So I think it can be done, but people have to think grassroots.
Yes, think local.
Yeah.
Well, the next question I'm going to ask you is back to the national stage, actually. But so forgive me for that.
Oh,
but,
sure.
In this new Obama administration, or this continuing Obama administration, or however you want to look at it, he's talking about how, well, we're more unified than I thought, and it's not quite to the point of George W. Bush saying he had a mandate to continue, even though he didn't even win the popular vote. But Obama is likely to take this whole election as a pat on the back, and what do you think is going to happen from that?
Well, there are some dangerous things. The most immediate dangerous things are going to be the impact on domestic spending, Social Security, and Medicare. And I think people have to start getting organized right now to fight to save that. And while there's, I think, quite a bit of action going on as far as Social Security and Medicare is going, I think one thing that is helpful to know about, to realize about the domestic spending, is that when you do away with a federal job, it's the same thing as doing away with firing a guy at the gas station. It's another job loss. And second
that
of all,
certainly makes, yeah.
Yeah, and second of all, if you cut federal spending, you're not just cutting federal spending, you're cutting local and state spending too. And because an awful lot of federal money ends up at the state and local level. And to give you an example, is I was somewhat stunned. I live in Maine, and we have a governor who is supported by the Tea Party. And the other day, he came out criticizing the plans to cut the budget because he was afraid about what effect it would have on his state. And that, I think, is a very powerful point that people could be making much more strongly, is that we're not talking about federal spending, we're talking about state and local spending as well. And I would say about the state and local thing, one thing that's bothered me for years is that liberals and progressives have basically ignored the importance of state and local government. It didn't used to be true. In fact, in the 1960s, the radicals were very much decentralists. But that's no longer true in the liberal community. And they're very heavily weighted towards people who think the federal government has all the answers. And it's one of the reasons why Democrats have had such a hard time. And I don't think it's an either-or thing. Just to give you an example, if you look, I was an officer in the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard was one of the most decentralized government agencies you could find. It was sort of like the National Park Service and also the U.S. attorneys, which are very decentralized. And what happens when the federal government becomes decentralized is that the people who are in the government at those agencies become essentially more responsible to the state and the local government. When I was on a ship in Rhode Island, we thought of ourselves as the town's navy. And the town thought of us that way, too. And
so it sounds by powering these decentralized or localized people who are involved in the government, you end up getting them to take more of a personal responsibility.
That's right.
For what
that's right. And they know, I mean, there's some very practical reasons, because if you're say, in running a national park, or you're in the Coast Guard in a small town, you don't want the governor or the mayor writing to Washington about how terrible you are. See? So there's a natural need to build alliances at the local level. And the interesting thing is that when you look at the popularity of various federal agencies, it is these decentralized ones which tend to be more popular I'll give you another example, which people don't think of, but it's the post office. Think about your local postal carrier. I've always liked my postal carriers. I mean, I've always thought they were among the nicest federal officials I've ever known.
I would agree.
We don't think about
it. No matter what the weather, you got to be out there, you know, carrying all that heavy stuff.
That's right. And so I think that's a, you know, if we start to think about it a little bit differently, let me just give you an example of something that we could do. The U.S. attorneys are essentially vetted by the senators. You know, you don't get to be a U.S. attorney unless the senators in your state say you're okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they may actually recommend you. Now, let's take a department like the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and let's say we'd have 50 state directors, and each one vetted like the U.S. attorneys. And they would be given a menu of programs and a budget that they could handle in each state, but they would have flexibility. And I would guarantee you that if you had that sort of a program, the feeling of the public towards the federal government would improve immensely. Now, basically, this is an idea. There was an old Catholic term about 100 years old called subsidiarity, which is that government should be carried out at the lowest practical level. And I think there's nothing wrong with liberals and progressives supporting that. It makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think this has been a very interesting discussion, and I really like this idea of subsidiarity, was it? Okay.
Yeah, subsidiarity.
Subsidiarity. I'm afraid that we're out of time, but thank you for joining us tonight. And
thanks for inviting me.
Oh, well, it's been a pleasure as always, and I'm sure we'll be doing it again before too long.
Great.
And again, thanks for sharing your thoughts.
And keep the faith.
Okay. Have a good night.
Night.
For decades, centuries, America and the world has been protected by those strong enough, smart enough to hear the voice of honor calling to their hearts, those brave warriors to whom we owe our freedom. Who can forget Dorothy Day, Emma Goldman, Eugene Debs, George McGovern, Peter Morin, Amon Hennessy, Lucy Parsons, Big Bill Haywood? And today we salute those who continue to answer the call. The few, the proud, the women from Code Pink. Food Not Bombs, a global force for good. Be all you can be. Join We Are Change or your local 9/11 Truth Group today. Aim high with the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. An army of one or two or three at 4 in the morning, underwater, through the swamp with a hammer in their teeth, over the fence, through the fence, into the building to hammer on United States military killing machines and destroy them. The Plowshares Movement, defending freedom and humanity since September 9th, 1980. And we're looking for a few good women in black. Be part of the action. The world can't wait. Veterans for Peace is not just a job, it's an adventure. Peace is our profession. Join the Occupy movement. There's strong, and there's Catholic workers strong. Semper Fi, hoorah.
Do we believe what we believe because we've studied things, held them in our hands, rolled them around, decided on our own about these important things and events? Or was it because we heard it on TV from somebody who was being paid to deliver the message? In a long road. From a stolen election to a government-planned attack on September 11, 2001, to two invasions based on lies, based on power, based on money, to a murdered senator, the one standing in their way, who would not be moved. We didn't want it to come. We marched. We emailed. We sang. We wrote. We got arrested. But it came anyway. And it's still here. The new American dream is a yellow ribbon free zone. We do not support the troops. The troops are not defending our freedom. They are thugs for the empire. We heard all about putting a boot up their ass from Toby Keith. Oh, what a brave man. Encourage other men to kill men, women, and children for no reason. The real patriots were the Dixie Chicks. We all know that now. Protesters protect our freedom. And that's the truth. Think Cynthia McKinney and Cindy Sheehan, not George Bush or John McCain. A hero does not drop bombs on people who are trying to live their lives. Come on. Teachers, priests, ministers, coaches, parents, please start telling the truth. We can handle the truth. In fact, without the truth, we cannot live. We will die slowly and then all at once. We'll collapse, and that will be that. It'll be over, dusty pile of rubble and ho-hos and lies. We need a new dream, something real, solid to believe in. Truth in our history books. Bread on the table of the poor. We have many heroes from which to draw inspiration, people who gave and are giving their lives to the truth. Patriots, if you will, saints, hard workers, whatever you want to call them, they're there. They've always been there, even if we don't see them, and even if they're not famous. They're driven by something inside of them. We can draw hope from the absolute fact that the same thing is also inside us. People like Daryl Ruhpiper, Kimberly Rivera, Roy Bourgeois, Megan Rice, Kevin McGuire, Marilyn Felian, Larry Rosebaugh, Greg Borky, John LaForge, Michael Whatley. This message brought to you by the good folks at World News Trust, the Spiritual UN, author James Boomy, the former Rock Creek Free Press, and the other individuals who've contributed over the past 20 months or so to bring you the New American Dream Radio Show. If you'd like to become an advertiser or supporter, check out our website, look for the donate button or the contact button, or just send me an email, cwg@cwgservices.com. Our thanks go out also to the many guests who've taken the time to visit with us over these months, and most especially to you. We thank you, listeners, for listening.
Well, it's been another long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. Along with all the election business, there's been a steady stream of burials at sea. And Kate King is the daughter of Jack Robert King and Cherry King, and Johnny King was her brother. A while back, you might recall, you might not, that Jack Robert King took his online podcast radio show on the road. He rode a bus from Nebraska to Oregon. He said he was looking for Bigfoot. But he wasn't just going to Oregon to see if he could have a Bigfoot experience. He also wanted to find out the truth about America. He just felt in his gut that he didn't know the whole story and he had to know. Well, he found out at least something, at least more than he knew before. And what we do know, that after he returned, well, a few weeks or months later, he and Cherry and Johnny were dead, and the radio show was no more. Little Kate saw the whole thing. She saw it all, and she ran. She ran into the corn that afternoon, and she lived. And she suffered, and she survived, and she learned. And today she is very, very angry, and very, very beautiful, and very, very capable, and so very alive. Recently, we saw how Kate was arrested while drawing on the curb during the presidential motorcade. Well, she wasn't arrested. They attempted to arrest her. She punched the policeman and the policewoman and got away into the crowd, into the night. Well, that same night that she got into the fight with the police, after she escaped and then was on the 10 o'clock news, she went to the bookstore to meet the friends who were supposed to have met her at the presidential parade, and she escaped the bookstore. Even with it being surrounded by police, she escaped into the night, into the flashing lights and the bullets and the bombs of America. She slept in an alley that night, and the next morning she boarded a bus, bound for anywhere, just to be going, to again be able to survive and think, and just as soon as she could, to mount her own attack. On the bus with her, or so she imagined, were other Illuminati, ones who know the truth about America. She saw one man who might have been a former FBI agent who knew the truth about the Wellstone death, and also an astronaut who knew the truth and had spent the last decades riding buses to escape being murdered like the other astronauts who had found out the truth. And there were others, and they rode the bus, just like Kate, moving, always moving, plunging into the darkness of another new night, trying to survive the American nightmare.
She fell asleep with her head bumping down the road on the glass. Sleeping Kate passed Gork and Bork and Torque, as well as Nork. Towns with windows lit by TV screens where Torkians and Norksters listened and learned and smiled and chuckled and fell asleep at last with the faint sound of chuckles in the air. She passed prisons and penitentiaries and correctional facilities and jails and detention centers and lockups and holding tanks and barbed wire, razor wire, brick and stone and rock. The bus took a curve too sharply and banged Kate's head against the window. She pulled her legs up, wrapped her arms around herself to dream of cornfields, baseball, and a large white front porch swing. Kate and the other dozing Illuminati passed by stone and brick homes with ponies and princess dolls. They passed garbage-strewn streets with weeping naked babies covered with freezing snot. At the county court of Gork, a family of four kicked a young man in shabby clothes up the steps, took turns kicking him. Across the street on the giant flat-screen TV, the family was cheered on by a newscaster wearing a suit, then by a team of cheerleaders, followed by a family of five seen in their vehicle from the window of the drive-in at Wendy's. The mother, father, sister, or brother kicked the young man in the stomach, the mouth, and genitals, mostly. Man rolled under the ancient stone archway, where high above the words of Abby Hoffman were etched in the marble. There is absolutely no greater high than challenging the power structure as a nobody, giving it your all, and winning. The man tried to rest, to resist for a moment there on his hands and knees, under the pointed shoe pummeling. Blood dripped out of his mouth and nose and ears under the granite pathway. On the walk, a woman wearing a mink coat had a minister on a jeweled collar out for his exercise. At the curb, she tugged on the lead. The minister plopped to his knees to cross the busy street.
In Gork, three TVs droned in each home and each door was locked and connected to a monitoring station with attendants watching computer screens eating Doritos. Each Gorkian had a likewise secure bank account at the State Bank of Gork with automatic monthly withdrawals going to the Church of Gork and the Gork Volunteer Fire Department. The locks on the bank and the church were likewise similarly monitored.
Each shotgun on each lap of each Gorker watching each TV aimed at a window through which a deviant with TVs on his mind might one night leap. While underneath the window, after dark, crept the banker and the minister and the fire chief. TVs were adorned on stands with lighted candles arrayed round. One cell was turned to SWAT, another cops, and the third always America's most wanted. On the streets of Gork, police cars, plunder, then rape, then pillage. Waited on each corner with lights flashing, sirens wailing. The Cork School Board divided the classes. Penitentiary, preparatory. In the hospital nursery, some newborns wore bracelets of blue and pink beads spelling out their names. The local blacksmith fitted the others with miniature handcuffs and shackles engraved with their register numbers, which would be replaced by larger accoutrements as they entered elementary or secondary school. To the moon, Alice! Kate leaned into the aisle to visit with the underground astronaut. One of these days. Kate smiled wide. That was Kennedy's proclamation, said the man. And 1 year later, John Glenn circling the globe. It's like a Stalin 5-year plan. You always get big brownie points for getting done early. He munched chips from a bag and brushed thin hair from his brow. You declare it's going to happen? By God, it happens, right? Kate looked at him. The moon. It's a giant spaceship, he said. Yeah, really, really, it is. Alien spies. They can see everything. The astronaut in Earth orbit pulled back into his chair cocoon, closed his eyes, pulled in his arms and legs as a turtle to its shell for nap time.
Kate turned back to her dark window and looked up at the full moon aglow, afire, eyes wide open, leering, peeking down at rich and poor alike. The moon looked down on a bus in the night and thousands of jails and prisons and penitentiaries in every county of every state in the United States of America. The wily spies on alien moon night duty gazed down through powerful scopes at the way the poor are kept that way and the way the rich keep themselves so well. They took midnight moon spaceship spy satellite night shift lunch break and then peered down upon Illuminati, who knew what was what is done, riding night buses to safety. And there was always one more bus to board. They saw the tired residents of Gork on volunteer night patrol clubbing the poor and dragging them behind the family SUV battleship destroyer out to the dump. The morning shift saw a young black man standing outside a trailer house with his father, talking about the young man enlisting in the army to give him a future. The mid-morning alien spy team saw a young couple talking to a banker in a small town begging for the money to buy their first sad little home and begin their long, desperate lives with one day of faux ecstasy. They gazed with wide-eyed wonder down the top of a young woman waitress as she ripped off her apron and fired it to the floor, quitting the best job she ever had to go home to work in the factory with her mother, noting on special spongy writing tablets the anger she displayed in the spittle, spewing from her mouth as she stormed away, leaving hot pancakes waiting on the counter.
Kate dreamed, thought, mooned over her family, her father, mother, and brother, all dead. The little kitten, Biggie, with the oversized paws, the pitch-black fur, the wet nose, snuggling her brother as they all sat on the porch, watching the corn and the stars and the moon. She turned her face against the window and washed it with her tears. Remembering the day they were all killed, murdered by the man and woman in the black SUV, how the helicopter rained bullets down upon her as she ran into the corn and slid under the old stalks to hide. She ran. She hid. They died. She lived. They bled and gasped for breath, drowned in their own blood, as she crept away on her hands and knees. But she was only a child, not yet 9. She ran away. She left them, the ones who'd fed her, dressed her, held her, ate ice cream with her on the sofa watching Tom Hanks movies. She let them die, and she lived. Her dad had told her to run, to go find Bigfoot, find the truth, but she didn't run to find Bigfoot. She ran because she was scared out of her mind. She screamed, ran into the ditch, fell on her face, scrambled under the barbed fence wire, wet herself, defecated in the new jeans her mother had bought for her in Sioux City. She's down there covered in dirt, had niblets of corn and corn stalks in her hair, and even though the man and woman in the SUV and the helicopter ran away too, and state patrolmen in their flying saucer hats looked for her in the corn, but they didn't find her. Because the crows had always hung out in the lane and the shelter belt, dived at their heads, and they got tired of swatting at the birds while searching for just a little scared girl with dirty clothes and hair, heart racing and tears streaming down her face, but they kept it all in while she heard their boots stomping in the corn. She swallowed her sobs and licked at her tears and burrowed like a wounded pheasant escaping the hunters. She did not let them find her, even though they called out, "Kate! Katie! Katie King! Where are you?" Because she'd heard her father tell her many times on the porch, these were not the men you run to for help. Run away.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO vote counters are about average.
And that's the end of another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We want to thank you again for listening. We love to do this show. Hope you'll stop back next week, same time, same place. And thanks to all our sponsors, World News Trust, James Boomey, the Spiritual UN. And thank you, Mike. Good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. And good night, Mark Olson. We're